This is Ray Sikora, and I am speaking with Karen Davis, who is the president and founder of United Poultry Concerns. Hi, Karen.
Hi, Ray. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you.
Good. Today we're going to focus on the environmental effects of industrial chicken production. And that is something I know that you know a lot about, so this should be really great. I bet I'm going to even learn a lot in this interview with you. So I want to just get right into it and start out our interview. First of all, by now pretty much everyone is familiar with the term factory farming to describe modern methods of raising animals, including chickens. And if you could just say exactly what this means for poultry. What is poultry factory farming? How are the birds raised in confinement? You know, just say a little bit about that.
Okay, Ray, sure. Well, people should first be made aware of the fact that chicken farming, that is the farming or the raising of chickens for meat, was actually the model for all subsequent factory farming of animals in the 20th century. Researchers started to see about enclosing birds who had formerly been, for the most part, running around outdoors on small farms and even in city areas. But certainly in the 20th century and what became the model following World War II was this effort in the United States to bring chickens inside and to raise them in concentrated confinement operations.
What was the reason for that? What made them say, okay, let's bring them indoors?
Well, because they wanted to, poultry farmers and researchers such as those at Cornell University, and feed mill companies such as Purina and the forerunner to General Mills, they all had a vested interest in creating an actual industry out of just scattered farmyard hatching of chicks and you know, and small farmers taking their unwanted birds to cities like Chicago or New York or Philadelphia from their farms to sell in the grocery stores, the marketplaces, you know, the markets and so on. Birds were hauled in before the, let's say, even up through the 1930s and 40s, birds would be hauled from the farms on which they were raised into the cities such as Chicago or New York, alive, and then they would be slaughtered in you know, in the back of a grocery store or something. So the you know, the people involved in animal agriculture and in the raising of chickens particularly and turkeys wanted to create an industry so that they could sell many more birds at a much cheaper rate and cost. So there was this whole interest in, and then the Depression, of course, also had an effect. And I think it was Harry Truman who had this slogan that became so famous about a chicken, seeing that there was a chicken in every pot after World War II. So it isn't that people didn't eat chickens in the past. If you read the literature in novels and other forms of literature describing earlier times, going back actually to ancient times, it's a sad fact that chickens have had the misfortune of being raised and slaughtered for food and kept for eggs and then slaughtered after they were considered no longer useful for egg production. So it's not like the eating of chickens or that Harry Truman's a chicken in every pot was going to really make a big change in people's eating habits. And also during World War II, poultry meat, chicken meat, was the one meat that was not rationed. So there were a lot of economic factors that came together, but the idea was post-World War II to consolidate chicken farming and chicken raising and slaughter into an industry and to be able to make a chicken the cheapest thing people could buy. And they actually held the A&P, the Great Atlantic and Pacific Tea Company, the A&P stores chain, actually held contests in the late 40s and early 50s to to create a winner of the bird who would grow the largest and have the most breast muscle tissue to become the model, the genetic model for what would become known as broiler chickens, the chickens who are to this day raised and slaughtered for meat throughout the world. And it was a man named Van Tress in California who actually won this contest, which the New England chicken producers were so shocked about. The chicken production really got started in Connecticut and other New England states, and eventually it moved down to the Mid-Atlantic and states such as Virginia, Maryland, and Delaware, and then also out to California. But this Van Tress chicken became the basis of the Tyson chicken, and in addition, they also had egg laying contests, you know, which farmer, which a researcher could create a hen who would lay the most eggs. This, again, was back in the 40s and 50s, and even in the 30s, you could read articles in Life magazine and the Saturday Evening Post about these contests, which were considered just wonderful. You know, everything was becoming mass-produced in the mid-20th century, before World War II, and then certainly after World War II, you had all these products that formerly people had to raise themselves or grow themselves, or that involved a lot more labor. But after World War II, you had all these things, everything from frozen orange juice to instant cake mixes and chicken that would be wrapped in cellophane at the local grocery store that had been hauled in from what then were becoming these centralized huge chicken slaughter plants. So in other words, everything in the 20th century moved from people just, you know, raising chickens and slaughtering them in their farms or their backyards or whatever, to becoming the industry that we now know today.
So this all laid the foundation for modern confinement operations for poultry and other animals.
Yes.
So if you could, this, you know, let's lay a foundation for talking about the environmental aspects of this by having you describe, what does it look like today? What are the numbers? What are the numbers of birds being raised, and what are the conditions that they're raised in?
Okay, Ray. Well, first of all, worldwide, the numbers of chickens raised and slaughtered for meat are estimated to be at least 40 billion and possibly 50 or 55 billion, with the understanding that the 40 to 50 billion represents statistics gathered by various agriculture departments representing countries throughout the world, that is, countries who provide their statistics. But it should also be understood that in the United States and in other countries, there are many millions of chickens who are slaughtered on smaller farms. Even though they're large, they're not considered large enough to be included in the United States Department of Agriculture figures. So the numbers are just astronomical. We're talking about at least 40, 50, maybe even 100 billion chickens worldwide. Certainly, hens in egg production operations, that is in battery cages, are estimated to be around 5 billion birds worldwide. And in this country, about 300 million hens are in battery cages at any given time. And we are now up to about 10 billion chickens being slaughtered annually in the United States. That is according to recorded figures. And just to give you an idea, when my book Prisoned Chickens, Poisoned Eggs was first published in 1996, the number of chickens recorded as being slaughtered in the United States was 7.5 billion. Now we're talking in the new revised edition of Prisoned Chickens, Poisoned Eggs, which just came out this year, where I'm recording close to 10 billion chickens in the United States alone. So as soon as you have numbers at this level, you have to think about the fact that these are animals. These are also animals who are many times larger than a normal chicken would be. For example, chickens raised and slaughtered for meat, called broiler chickens, are slaughtered at around 6 weeks old, and they weigh about 6 pounds. Now, this means that a normal chicken who at 6 weeks old, barely over a month old, a month and a half old, who would weigh barely a pound, has been genetically manipulated to now weigh about 6 pounds, which means gaining a pound a week. Not only has this created huge, huge destructive effects upon the chicken's body and livability, and increasing the tendency for these birds to almost all be painfully lame. But in addition, this means that the that huge amount of weight per chicken, plus the filthy diet that they're fed, including all the antibiotics and the antifungals and everything else that goes into their diet, means that per chicken, you have a much more manure being produced than you would even if you had, let's say, 9 or 10 billion normal-sized chickens. So we need to keep that in mind. Well, you have two major aspects of this huge population of chickens, this nearly 10 billion in the U.S. alone, and the startling increase in the number of birds in just the last decade. You have dead birds, and you have slaughterhouse refuse, what they call slaughterhouse refuse, and you have manure. So the question is, where is all this manure? Where do all these dead birds go? And I should bring to people's attention the fact that even though the U.S. slaughters at least 9 billion or so chickens per year, in U.S. Department of Agriculture inspected facilities, and inspected should be in quotation marks, millions and millions of chickens die before they ever get to slaughter. They die of all kinds of undiagnosed diseases, which can be anything from cancerous tumors to bacterial infections, viral infections, fungal infections, or it could be a combination of all of those. So
what happens to those birds, the ones who die but don't go to slaughter? What happens to those bodies when we're looking at the waste?
Well, interestingly, the poultry industry and the entire poultry and livestock industry like to use the word recycling. They talk about recycling the dead birds and even the manure back into poultry and livestock feed. The industry makes it clear when industry folks are talking to one another through their journals and trade magazines and conferences that they have a huge environmental waste problem. So what are they going to do with the enormous amount of manure and what's known in chicken production, that is chicken meat production, as litter? And this is the bedding that the birds are raised on. And let me say a word about this. This bedding is made up of wood shavings and or sawdust. Okay, so let's say you lay down a bedding of wood of these wood shavings and or sawdust in a 600-foot-long chicken house, such as we have everywhere here in Virginia, where United Poultry Concerns and our sanctuary are located, and you install 30,000 chickens per flock in that house, maybe 5 or 6 times per year over a period of, let's say, 3 years before it's cleaned out. Okay, as the Washington Post wrote a couple of years ago, by the time there's what they call a total crust out, because by now what you have is just manure, basically, and all the wood shavings and everything have been decomposed and absorbed by the manure, you have at least 9 parts manure to 1 part wood product. So these birds are living in their own manure, and this manure mess, which again includes antibiotic residues and cysts and dead birds, because birds die, as we just mentioned, constantly in the chicken houses. They have heart attacks and die of multiple production-related diseases. Much of this manure is spread on the land. A lot of it goes into waterways, such as the Chesapeake Bay down here where we are living, which is a huge environmental catastrophe at this very moment. And a lot of it is fed to cattle. One of the ways that the industry recycles its filthy, infested poultry manure, again, and what's called litter, this bedding that is now cleaned out after a few years of having been the bedding over a million chickens lived on, excreting the whole time, what the industry, and this is full of pathogens, disease-causing microorganisms, salmonella, campylobacter, listeria, again, just so many interactive pathogens that you can hardly even imagine. This mess is put out, farmers are encouraged to graze their cattle on it. And the U.S. Department of Agriculture encourages this practice of grazing cattle on used poultry litter, again, which is just a mess of disease organisms, and it's basically chicken manure. In other words, the two twin environmental issues are the many millions of dead chickens. The question is, where do they go? And all of the manure, well, where does it go? Well, it seeps into waterways, it poisons wells, it burns plants, because when you have too much nitrogen in the soil from the chicken droppings, a little bit of nitrogen is very good for raising plants, as everybody knows. But this nitrogen product, which comes from the uric acid in chicken manure, again, when there are just a few chickens roaming widely on a large piece of land, then that uric acid, which on being excreted becomes a nitrogen product, is very good for vegetation. But when you have a buildup such as I have just described in a chicken house, which is basically enclosed, is very poorly ventilated, and which is filled with pollutions and thousands and thousands of dead and live bodies, then you have a poison, a toxin. And so, the question is, where does all this manure go? Down here on the Eastern Shore, you have a very small peninsula land mass, and the poultry industry insists that the real problem, such as was discussed on Frontline on April 21st on PBS, that the problem is not, as Frontline observed and showed, the huge concentration of thousands of poultry houses down here around the Chesapeake Bay in Delaware, Maryland, and Virginia. The industry wants to say, well, it's the increasing population in these formerly rural, largely rural, sparsely populated areas coming down from Washington, D.C. and Baltimore down into Virginia, Delaware, and Maryland, and that, the infrastructures that are required to maintain these urbanized populations is the main cause of the destruction of the Chesapeake Bay, the pollution of the Chesapeake Bay.
In that show, what the industry, the poultry industry, ended up saying is that the bay needs better sewage treatment, not
right.
chicken farms. Which
right, exactly. The poultry industry says that the problem is that the sewage treatment systems need to be improved. That getting rid of chicken houses is not what's needed down here. Well, I just want to tell you that I've been.
They didn't want at all for them to focus on the fact that, I mean, in that show, they talked about that the industrial chicken farms generate 1.5 billion pounds of chicken waste yearly. And that's more than all the human waste from New York, Washington, D.C., San Francisco, and Atlanta combined.
Right.
You know, so the industry didn't talk about that. You know, instead they chose to focus on something that isn't based on reality, which is, oh, we just need better sewage treatment.
Well, they want people to, you know, they want people to continue to increase the amount of chicken they consume, and that's understandable from their standpoint. And they want to continue to increase the profitability of producing and selling chickens. So, I mean, that's their vested interest. And just like what we're seeing now with this swine flu outbreak, you know, you've got the industry actually changing the name from swine flu to H1N1 flu. And that's what they're calling it now, the 2009 H1N1 flu, so that people will not stop buying pork chops, pork products, and bacon, and so on, out of fear that they could get sick from this swine flu. So the industry, and with the full collusion of the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the State Departments of Agriculture, are all in this together. They want to maintain and increase the amount of chicken consumption or pork consumption, as the case may be, animal consumption, and they will spin and euphemize words and do whatever they can in order to make that happen and to keep the public from feeling that people have anything to fear from handling and or ingesting these products. And I should also mention, you know, the hens who are living in the battery cage operations, they do not live on the bedding I was describing that the meat-type chickens live on. They are living in, for the most part, 98% or 7%. They're living in little wire cages. And under these cages, you have mounds and mounds and mounds of manure. And once again, you've got this breakdown of uric acid, which becomes a penetrating toxic ammonia fumes, which, as I mentioned earlier, out when there's a little bit of it out in the soil, it's a nitrogen product and it stimulates the growth of plants. But when this uric acid from the manure, which is when there's so much manure in such huge concentrations inside these chicken and egg production buildings, then you have literally a toxic waste environment. And I've been inside many chicken houses in many battery cage operation facilities. And when you open the door, even if it's been emptied for a week, the toxic ammonia fumes from the uric acid in the manure burns into your eyes and into your throat and lungs. It's just amazing to me that, you know, we talk about the environment, but I think that it's very important for people to understand that these chickens are living in the most concentrated toxic environment that you could possibly imagine. Many of them go to slaughter blind from the ammonia fumes. And when these ammonia fumes attack the eyes, you have a very, very painful corneal ulceration. So this is what these birds are living in. They basically go to slaughter blind or semi-blind and certainly with extreme eye pain from all the ammonia fumes and the other toxic gases that fill up these houses. And they also are virtually all lame from the skeletal inability to maintain the huge amount of body weight that they're carrying. Or if they're in egg production industry situations, then they tend to have osteoporosis because they lived crammed in wire cages and they could never move their limbs. So we know that when your bones don't get exercise, you get osteoporosis. So one of the things I'm pointing out here is that we don't want to forget the environment that our victims, the core victims of animal agriculture, are actually forced to live in. If we think it's bad out here, outside the chicken house, try to imagine what it's like inside, where these poor birds, who are natives of the tropical forests of Southeast Asia and India, a bright, vibrant, healthy world, are now locked up in these dark shithouses.
Yeah. I've also visited some of the battery cage facilities that have hundreds of thousands of birds, both here and overseas, and have experienced the same thing, walking in, having a hard time breathing, my eyes burning, and seeing birds who had fallen out of the stacked up battery cages down in these manure pits, struggling down in the manure pits. Many dead birds, but many live birds.
I know, just think about how they feel down there.
Yeah, and only a few workers in the facilities. And, you know, and I would just ask a lot of questions and find out how often are the cages cleaned. And, you know, they were basically only hosing down the cages between loads of birds. So, you know, once a year or so they would take the birds out and send them to slaughter and replace them with new birds and hose this down in between, but they wouldn't clean out the manure once a year.
You know, right. Do you know why?
When it got so high.
They don't want to spend the money. As I quote in my book, Prison Chickens, Poisoned Eggs, which I really encourage people to buy. They can go right to our website at upc-online.org, right on our homepage. They can click on the press release. They can click on the order form, and they can order the book, and it is fully referenced. And I describe there, for example, a meeting I attended about the egg industry and salmonella a couple of years ago, where the egg industry spokesperson complained about how hard it is to clean out these egg production facilities, these where these hens live in these little wire, thousands of hens are trapped in these little wire cages. And he was quite frank about it. He said, you know, it takes over 2 weeks to clean these places. You have to have like a whole labor force to do it. And even after you spend 2 weeks trying to clean up these filthy places, they're still not clean because the disease organisms are living in the pipes where the water is channeled into the little nipple drinkers that these birds are forced to get only one drop at a time from. They're in the wood. You cannot clean these houses. Nature did not intend animals to live this way. There's nothing in the natural world that even begins to compare with the concentration of thousands and thousands of animals and umpteen tons of manure in a very small landmass. So we've created an unnatural and a pathogenic situation for these animals and for what should be their beneficial droppings as far as maintaining a healthy environment. We've created just the opposite. We've created sick animals, an environment which is groaning under all the pollution and the filth that's pouring out into it from these poultry operations. And here's, for example, what Donald Bell, who is a chicken researcher at the University of California, Riverside, he wrote this in a poultry magazine. He said, the amount of animal wastes produced in the U.S. is staggering. In chickens, for example, the daily production of waste is essentially equal to the amount of feed used, that is the food. This means that for every truckload of feed that is brought onto the farm, a similar load of waste must be removed. A 1 million hen complex produces 125 tons of wet manure a day.
Wow.
Or you read, in California, an egg factory with 837,000 caged hens produces 21,000 cubic yards of manure per year, the equivalent of 1,400 dump truck loads. And then we read, the Delmarva Peninsula, which is where our organization, United Poultry Concerns, is located and where, and which was the focus of the PBS Frontline documentary on April 21st, the Delmarva Peninsula, Delaware, Maryland, and Virginia, produces 1 million tons of manure a year, enough to fill a football stadium to the top row, including all the concourses, locker rooms, and concession areas. So there, I mean,
we need those kinds of visuals, because if you tell me how many dump truckloads, I can't even fathom thousands of dump truckloads, what that really means. Now, give me a football stadium full, I got it. You know, I get the amount that that is. It's incredible.
Right.
I have a couple other questions for you. I wanted to, you know, you talked a little bit about swine flu. And, you know, a couple of years ago, there was a lot of press about bird flu or avian influenza. I mean, avian influenza. And I'm wondering if you could just touch on that a little bit, if there is a relation between what we're hearing now, the swine flu, and what we heard about a few years ago, bird flu. And by the way, the bird flu scare, it's like, I don't know what happened to it. It was big, you heard about it, and then suddenly it wasn't in the news anymore. Now swine flu is in the news, and I imagine at some point we're not going to hear about it again. But what are the underlying factors that relate those? And
well, actually, in 2007, United Poultry Concerns produced a report called Avian Influenza, parenthesis Bird Flu, What You Need to Know. Again, a fully referenced report, which people can find right on our website in the Health and Nutrition section on our homepage. But first of all, you've got this concentration of birds, not only in the United States, but certainly in China, which is considered a kind of birthplace of avian influenza going back many, many thousands of years. And we know about the avian influenza pandemic that occurred during World War II. And the same causes are always identified. You know, filth, crowding of human beings, of animals together creates a paradise for these types of pathogens. In the case of the pandemic in World War II, of course, it was pointed out that, you know, a common denominator, a common link between the sick birds and sick human beings was, you know, the immune systems of birds, like the immune systems of human beings and all other biological organisms, animals, have evolved to be able to cope with a certain amount of a pathogenic invasion. Our bodies have, and birds' bodies have evolved to be able to screen out and prevent from ingestion and other routes of invasion a whole host of pathogenic, that is, disease-causing organisms. But the situations that we have created here in the United States and in other countries, and that has prevailed really for many thousands of years in China, is that you know birds are very, very crowded together. The crowding of animals or any animals at all means a filth. It means manure buildup. It means a stress upon the immune system that makes these animals, including humans, much more susceptible to disease, because the resistance, the immune system's resistance, can only cope with so much stuff at a time. So here you have concentration of birds. You have an ideal opportunity for viruses such as the avian flu virus, which I should explain comes in many, many, many different strains. Depopulations of chickens and turkeys, for example, that depopulations, that is the mass killing of birds in the chicken houses or the turkey houses to get rid of a particular strain of avian flu. This takes place all the time. And in fact, I got a letter from a man in Texas very recently near Waco, Texas, who talked about how there was an outbreak of a certain strain of bird flu down there where he lives. And he said, and of course they mass destroyed a number of the birds, and they sent many others on to slaughter, you know, with the idea that, well, you know, nobody would know about this, and that this particular strain of bird flu is not known to be transmittable to human beings, so therefore they can be slaughtered and they can be sold as a human food. But he also pointed out that, you know, that thousands and thousands of dead birds were and regularly are trucked in open-air trucks. So that means that the feathers, the contaminated feathers, pieces of excrement, dust, and everything are flying off out of these trucks and landing, you know, along the road and along the sides of the road and being picked up by the air and swept around. So, and this was a point that was made by the environmental watchdog group named GRAIN, when they were avidly following the avian influenza outbreaks that took place in 2006, and were pointing out that all over the world where there's a poultry industry, you have all these trucks loaded with dead birds, and birds spilling out practically over the top of these trucks or falling on the ground and so on. And this, and the trucks flying along the road to the rendering companies. The rendering companies are the ones who pick up the birds or have the facilities to which the birds are brought to be turned into poultry and livestock feed. But the point is that these dead birds and the feces and the dust and the all of the stuff that's clinging to them, including the dead birds themselves, often fall out of the trucks, and they're just, all this stuff is just being picked up by the wind. If it rains, the stuff soaks into the waterways. And I mean, it's just very difficult, Ray, to really describe how monumental this pollution is, and the extent to which and the governments around the world just closed a blind eye because they're so concerned with increasing the economic profitability of animal agriculture. They will not address it. And even though it was great that Frontline on PBS did presented such a strong investigative documentary about the effects of the poultry industry on the Chesapeake Bay here in the mid-Atlantic states, the fact is that this issue has been discussed and discussed and discussed for decades. It's kind of like Campylobacter, which is the main bacterial infection that virtually all chickens end up in supermarkets covered with. Consumer Reports regularly tests chickens that they purchase at the supermarket for salmonella and this other bacteria called Campylobacter. And despite the fact that, you know, you would think reading newspaper articles today that Campylobacter was just recently being recognized as a serious a bacterial infection that is transmitted to humans who handle and consume chicken and turkey, and causes severe stomach cramps, diarrhea, can cause central nervous system problems, and so on. You would think that this was a brand newly discovered organism that needs to be addressed, when in fact, you can go back to the 80s, the 1980s, and perhaps even earlier, in the case of salmonella, and you'll see the same discussions. And they occasionally, there's some mention of something in the New York Times or the Washington Post, or in the UK in the Guardian, but somehow, or in Time magazine, or in a magazine called Eating Well. And you read these articles, and going back decades now, and then you're looking at well, okay, that was in like 1980, okay, or 1985. Now it's 2009. And we're still having the same discussions. We're still talking about
new news.
Yeah, we're still talking about tightening regulations and whether that should be done and who should do it. And it's just amazing the extent to which not even human health seems to have any effect upon, well, of course not on the industries themselves, but not on the government either. So and even consumers somehow reading these articles don't seem to be able to get the message or to incorporate it in such a way that they would make a serious change in their eating habits or that of their children.
So I'm wondering, for you, you've been working in this for so many years, and it's obvious the industry, government, they're not going to do anything about this as long as it's a profitable industry. And individuals are pretty numb to new information. They're just like, we've always eaten this way, I'm sure it's fine, the experts will take care of us, and if the experts won't take care of us, the doctors will later. What do you think could make a difference in this? What do you think could make a difference in both, you know, the lives of the birds themselves, but also in just getting rid of these industries that are destroying the planet? I mean, it's really common to hear about the destructive effects of grazing cattle and how large-scale cattle grazing destroys the rainforest and depletes the land. And we rarely hear about chicken and egg production being destructive. And then when you do, people just kind of, you know, blow it off. It's, you know, they think, oh, chicken production, it's not that big a deal. But even the ones that are known as a big deal, that do get press, that grazing cattle and growing feed for cattle is really causing irreversible damage to the environment, people don't make a change. What do you think is going to really shake people into making the changes that they need to make as consumers?
Well, Ray, I wish I could answer that.
I've been looking
for that button ever since I started to do the work I do, advocating on behalf of compassion and respect for chickens, turkeys, ducks, and other domesticated fowl. I'm not sure what is going to get people's attention, just because our organization and other organizations have been hard at it, let's say, going back at least to, if you want to set a date for the modern animal advocacy and really the even vegetarian movements, I think we can talk about the mid-1970s, certainly the, you know, the publication in 1975 of Peter Singer's Animal Liberation was really the book that woke up many, many people about the horrible treatment of animals on factory farms and associated problems that result in in health problems in people from eating these animals, and also in the environmental effects. So if we're looking at, you know, from around 1975 to the present, and we're looking at an increase in the number and the activity of vegetarian, vegan societies, we're looking at more coordination between vegetarian societies and animal advocacy organizations. We are looking at a proliferation of small animal advocacy groups and grassroots groups. And we're seeing a greater attention to farmed animal issues, which, you know, before the 1970s, the large animal welfare organizations didn't even address farmed animals at all. Most of the boards of directors ate animals, and there are still at least two of the largest animal protection, so-called animal protection organizations in the U.S., as well as their counterparts in other countries like the U.K., who to this day, you know, support eating animals and really are in hand in hand with the industries that abuse and produce these animals. So, but the point is that even with all the demonstrations that have been held in front of places like KFC and, you know, the huge amount of effort that has gone into, and the conferences also, the animal advocacy conferences, the vegetarian conferences. So you kind of look at all this, and then the newspaper accounts, which have increased in recent years about the mistreatment of chickens and turkeys and these undercover investigations that groups are doing and showing the horrible abuse of these birds, for example, kicking them and pulling their heads off and torturing them just as an amusement or to vent rage in these places by the workers. So you look at all of this stuff together and you say, well, how come with all this information that at least we are paying attention to, that is those of us involved on behalf of animals and vegetarianism, and yet the amount of the number of vegetarians is said to not be being significantly increased, and now we're seeing a really frightening phenomenon where many people are, like, for example, there was an article in Gourmet magazine this issue or the previous issue all about how people who used to be vegan are now feeling that they can go back to eating meat, dairy, and eggs because they are being assured even by certain animal rights organizations, or not animal rights, but animal welfare, whatever, organizations, and people like Michael Pollan and these pundits who write regularly for the New York Times and so on, that all that particular group is leading people to feel that they can, with good conscience, go back to eating animal products because now they can have humane meat, humane this, that, and the other, humanely raised pork and
it's
chicken.
Local and yeah, exactly.
Right, you've got the locavores and the you know, all rooftop chicken producing people and so I don't know what the answer to it is. I do know this, that United Poultry Concerns, my organization, has always argued that when we talk to people, and by the way, May 4th is International Respect for Chickens Day, and the month of May is International Respect for Chickens Month, and we urge people to do an action, no matter how simple, but a positive action on behalf of chickens on or around May 4th and or in the month of May, whether it's leafleting on a busy street corner or holding a library display or writing a letter to the editor, doing something to draw attention to the plight of chickens and to do something to encourage people to want to try a vegan diet. We do not support, we don't support animal agriculture, period, because I know from my own research that no matter how benign a family farm may sound or how pretty the term free range is, these are really terms that do not show what animals really go through in being raised and slaughtered for food. Just the very fact that chickens and other animals raised for food are not allowed to, you know, they're separated from their mothers. They don't get to have a normal family life. They are regularly culled, that is C-U-L-L-E-D, that is the ones who are not growing fast enough or who have some kind of a defect or who are not wanted for one reason or another, are brutally destroyed. They break their necks and dead or alive, throw them into garbage cans, piles. I mean, the whole history of farming does not in any way support the romantic idea that farming has ever been nice to animals who were farmed. And I tell people that, you know, we know that human slavery is not humane. How could anybody think that non-human animal slavery would somehow magically be humane? It just isn't. So I don't know what the answer to it is, because I see all these different approaches that various groups have made, and everybody trying to find what button to push or what magic formula to use to get people to want to be compassionate towards their fellow creatures, improve their health, and move away from an animal-based diet. And so our approach is we never let people forget the animals, in our case, the birds themselves, and the misery that they endure in being considered a food source. At the same time, we draw attention to the fact that there are health problems and serious environmental problems that result from raising animals for food, and particularly when we're talking about over 6 billion people, likely to be 9 billion by 2050. Okay, how in the world does anybody think for a minute that you can have mass consumption of poultry and egg products, just to cite the largest number of land-raised animals, apart from fish, that human beings are consuming throughout the globe. How does anybody think for a minute that you can have mass consumption and not have mass production methods? A few upscale people might be able to buy some so-called, whatever they want to call it, because it's really a dishonest language, but, you know, meat from animals slaughtered in some small farms. But that's always going to be a very small number of upscale people who can afford it and who even follow that kind of news. But for the majority of people increasingly becoming urbanized, who want to run into a supermarket, get meat as cheaply as possible, get cheap eggs and cheap dairy products and cheap cheese and all of the rest of it, you're going to have mass production and you're going to have mass misery of animals. And that's just a fact.
It is. And, you know, if you really look at it, like, I have visited these smaller farms that call themselves organic, humane, local, all that on their labels. And I have visited there. And what I have determined is that if everyone would just visit the places and find out every step that it takes to bring that food to them, that the majority of people would not support what they see, even at these, you know, the most ideal farm that calls themselves humane. And, you know, you still have birds like, you know, turkeys who in, you know, 18 weeks are so large that their legs can't hold them. And, you know, you still have the conditions. You still have manure going into local waterways. You have all of that going on. So if people can visit these places and they can see every step and then still feel good about it, well, I would be surprised. I don't know anyone who could look at that and say, okay, I want to support this. But it's very hard to get people to take that kind of responsibility for their choices.
Well, we should also keep in mind, again, not to emphasize the pessimistic note, but just to emphasize that throughout the world and history, and in most parts of the world, even today, and up until the well into the 19th century, and even into the 20th century, certainly the 1930s in Western industrial countries, farmed animal production was not hidden away. People saw animals being driven to market right through the town. People saw animals being slaughtered. Most people lived on farms and slaughtered their own animals. So, I mean, one of the ironies and frightening paradoxes about, you know, the idea of, well, if people just saw how these animals are treated, they would certainly not choose to eat them. I would like to think that was true, but I do want to draw attention to the fact that throughout history, people have seen how badly animals are treated. Most people, as I say, lived on farms, slaughtered their own animals, destroyed unwanted animals, gathered them up and sent them into, gave them to haulers to take to cities for live bird markets and whatnot. And so people have seen and participated directly in what we're talking about. So the question is, what does it take? It seems to me that if people live with in a world where they're used to seeing animals treated poorly and seeing them suffer and hearing them bellow and cry and so on, And that didn't keep them from eating these animals. And now the animals are increasingly completely out of sight in huge warehouses. Like down here on the Eastern Shore, you can see like chicken houses all over the place. But unless you know what you're looking at, you would have no idea that these tombs, these long, low tombs that are everywhere, actually each one has 30,000 birds inside it. So either they're out of sight from people's, they're out of sight, out of mind because they're literally out of sight physically, or they're out of sight, out of mind because people see it so much that it doesn't register on their conscience or their consciousness. I do want to point out something else here too, just to, again, to get a little facticity in here about going back to what you were saying earlier about how there's a lot of attention being given to cattle grazing and yet seemingly very little attention as yet being given to the effects on the environment of the of raising chickens and turkeys. But for example, the Chesapeake Bay Foundation has pointed out in their reports that even though hog and dairy operations produce more manure than chicken or turkey operations, poultry litter, which I described earlier as the mixture of fecal droppings, antibiotic residues, heavy metals, cysts, larvae, decaying carcasses, and sawdust that the birds are forced to walk on and peck in and everything else while they're alive, that this poultry litter has four times the nitrogen and 24 times the phosphorus of what is produced in hog and dairy operations. So, again, I don't know what that means to most people listening to who even pay attention to this topic. I'm also fascinated by the fact that, well, it's kind of understandable if you go into a restaurant, as I frequently do traveling, and the menu is almost entirely, whether it's an Indian restaurant or a Mexican restaurant or an Italian restaurant or whatever it may be, still all of the highlighted and the large majority of entrees on the menu are all loaded with animal products, particularly chicken and cheese, pork, beef, you name it. And then maybe there's a little section in some of these places, a little vegetarian section, that even that will often include things like shrimp or
yes,
cheese or eggs. I can have some understanding of when you walk into a restaurant and the smells of cooking flesh and so on assails your nostrils and you're with guests and the atmosphere looks so pretty and everything, so you just sort of say, well, you know, I mean, I wouldn't, but you know, and but I'm just saying the average person who cannot really make it, is not making a connection between, let's say, food and the animals themselves. But, you know, when you walk into a supermarket and you're looking, this is what amazes me. When you see all this dead flesh, and I when I'm standing at the counter waiting to check out at local Food Lion, for example, down here where we live in a rural area, and I'm, or even the organic store down, there's a little organic food market here called Quail Cove. And they have a lot of vegan items, and they sell pretty well, but see, nothing compares to the selling of the so-called organic chicken, organic turkey, organic ham, organic eggs, organic milk, and organic cheese. Almost everybody, that's what they load up on. That's it. And so my question is, you know, when you look at these big dead bodies and you're still hungry, and as Reverend Andrew Lindsay, who's written prolifically about the suffering of animals raised for food, said, back in his childhood, there was nothing more enticing to people in England than seeing the carcasses of pigs and turkeys and other animals hanging upside down outside the markets, that enticed people to want to go in and buy them. And if anybody's ever read Scrooge, called A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens, I strongly recommend that because people may forget, and I don't know to what extent the TV versions of A Christmas Carol bring all this out, but if you read the story, which is not very long, A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens, you will see that the big prize and the symbol of Scrooge becoming a humane person is when he goes out and picks the biggest turkey, dead turkey, hanging upside down in the local market and brings it back to Tiny Tim and shows his humanity to Tiny Tim after previously being so mean. That this turkey, the buying of the big dead turkey, Christmas turkey and bringing it and presenting it to Tiny Tim and his impoverished family, that is considered the symbol of Scrooge's rebirth. And when Scrooge is finally, in his so-called new humane aspect, is dreaming of the ultimately happy life for a human being, including himself now, he is actually lying in Charles Dickens' story in a pile, a huge heap of meat, sausages and turkeys and everything. I mean, it's really quite eye-opening, and I incorporated this whole passage from A Christmas Carol into my book, More Than a Meal, The Turkey in History, Myth, Ritual, and Reality. And I certainly draw people's attention to that book if they're interested in learning just about everything you might want to know about turkeys, including the sad relationship they have with human beings. But that just gives you an example. I mean, here's a book that is considered a classic and a wonderful story of a human conversion from being a bad person into being a good and caring person. And yet animal abuse, farmed animal abuse, and meat are the very symbol of this man's conversion from being bad to being a good.
Yes.
So that shows something about our culture.
Yeah, I mean, I think that in human culture, it typically has been the way that you show you care is by having very rich animal foods at something. And of course, we would like to see that change, but it's definitely part of the culture. Well, Karen, I think we're going to wrap up here, but it has been so great chatting with you, and I learned a lot. And I want to give folks your website, www.upc-online.org, where they can go for more information. And if there is anyone who is interested in passing out vegan food along with their literature to bring folks in, there is a new organization which is giving funding to any individual or group who wants to give vegan food samples along with educational literature, and you can find them at www.vegfund.org. So, Karen, thank you so much. Are there any last points that you want to make before we wrap up here?
Well, Ray, I would just say that I would really, really, really urge people to try all the wonderful vegan foods that are available increasingly in supermarkets and grocery stores and places where food is sold throughout the United States and even, I hope, the world. And that, you know, one of our mottos is don't just switch from beef to chicken, go vegan. Or don't just switch from beef to chicken, get the slaughterhouse out of your kitchen. I really urge people to think about these birds and other animals, about what it means for them to live in the dark, as most of them do now on the earth, stripped of the sunshine, the fresh air, the comfort and joy that they would have had had they not come in contact with us and our appetites. And to urge people to remember we do not need to eat these animals, we do not need to eat the products from their bodies, and we just want to see other creatures treated with the same compassion that we ask for ourselves. They deserve no less, and we've got abundant food on this planet, abundant. When people say things like, oh, well, what am I going to eat? Well, I'm surprised when they're still asking that question. You walk into any supermarket, and supermarkets are everywhere here, certainly in the United States, even in rural areas like ours, and you can find abundant foods that aren't made up of the suffering bodies of animals. So we just urge people to look at vegan cuisine and vegan cooking and dining as a real adventure, a pioneer attitude that is in keeping with our culture, along with all the meat eating, but that really advances us in a positive and significant way to become more civilized and more compassionate.
Karen, thank you so much for your beautiful work and your dedication and your compassion. It's really beautiful. And I urge everyone to please go to UPC's website, and there is so much more important information there. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ray. Have a good day.
Yes, you too. Okay, bye-bye, Karen.
Bye.